All over India, today, Krishna Janmashtami is being celebrated, and tomorrow also, with great religious fervor. It is on the 8th day of the dark fortnight of this particular month that an avatar is said to have descended on earth, who was known as Sri Krishna. His advent, it is said, was during the transition period between the end of one age, the Copper Age or Dwapara Yuga, and the beginning of the next age, the Iron Age, the Kali Yuga. And as said in the scriptures, the purpose of the great avatar coming down was to restore order, thrust the evil propensities that had developed and become rampant, and re-establish righteousness and give the teachings which are necessary for the people during the whole of the Iron Age. Sri Krishna is regarded as one of the great avatars. And his birth anniversary is celebrated with great religious fervor, as already said. There are various ways of observing this event. Mostly, the masses resort to idol worship and rituals and so on. But since we are thinking beings, manasas, our bondage to conditioned existence is due to thought diverted to wrong, diverted in the wrong direction due to misconceptions. And our freedom from this conditioned existence to our true goal of life is again due to thought alone. When it is directed towards truth, therefore, the proper way of observing the event, such events of great import, when we honor great personages, enlightened ones, the sages, the teachers who come, is by trying to know and understand the message they brought and try to put them into practice in our lives and aim towards the great goal and the ideal they have pointed out. That seems to be the proper way of honoring such great personages. But this is not to say that what the masses do is not correct. See, as children grow, into adulthood, they don't stick on to toys. They give up. And take up mind and intellectual development, and development of their intellect and moral nature. Similarly, we have to overcome, we have to pass the stage of mere formal outer observances and attend to the spirit of things, the spirit of the teachings of the great ones, thereby we will be doing them real honor. And it is one of our duties to do so, because one of the great five duties the scriptures prescribe is study of the teachings of the great ones. It's a duty that we owe. Therefore, what we will do this evening is to recall the teachings of Sri Krishna and dwell upon them. Of course, it is not possible to cover all his teachings, which can be found extensively in Bhagavata Purana, in the Vishnu Purana, and Mahabharata. They are very extensive. But the essence of all this is found in this marvelous devotional book, the Bhagavad Gita, in 700 verses. So, we will take up a few verses from the Bhagavad Gita and try to understand some of the teachings of Sri Krishna. Now, as already said, Krishna is said to be an avatar of Mahavishnu. Now, who is Mahavishnu? He is not an anthropomorphic god sitting in some heaven. So, we must give up all that kind of anthropomorphic ideas. And try to understand the philosophical principle, the philosophical, metaphysical idea underlying that name, Mahavishnu. Now, if we see the etymology of Vishnu, Vish means in Sanskrit to pervade in one sense. The one universal divine principle, absolute, pervades like space, everything, as Krishna said in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Like air, the all-pervading air in space, that divine principle is all-pervading, wish to pervade. In another sense, wish comes from the root. Wish means to enter into. And Vishnu Purana says this, yasmat, because vishtam idam vishvam tasya shaktya mahatmanaha, vishtam idam vishvam, this universe he entered, tasya shaktya mahatmanaha, this great soul by his power of material essence, he entered this universe which he created. Tasmat prochite Vishnu, therefore he is called Vishnu. All pervading one life, from which emanate these all worlds, into which he enters by the power of his material essence, in which he dwells, all dwell in him. Therefore, he is called Mahavishnu. Vish, Vishet, Dhatu, dhatu is the etymological root of the word dhatu. The root of the word vish is pravesh. Therefore, he is called Mahavishnu. Therefore, all that exists is aspects of Mahavishnu. Sarvecha Deva Manava Samastha. All these gods and Manus, Saptarishayaha, seven great hierarchies, Manasuravascha, the progeny of Manus, Indraschaiva Ayam, Tritashesha Bhuto, Vishnu Asheshastu Vibhutayastaha. All this whole manifested universe are aspects of Him. All the beings, all the creatures are aspects of that one supreme power. All pervading, entering in all, dwelling in all. This is the idea of Mahavishnu. So, he is supposed to be an avatar of Mahavishnu. Now, what is an avatar? As the etymology of the word itself shows, avatarana, that he who descends, avatara. In the theosophic glossary, avatara is defined as divine incarnation, descent of a god or some exalted being who has progressed beyond the necessity of rebirths into the body of a simple mortal. This is an avatar. And it is said these avatars come periodically. There is a periodicity to this descent of divinity on earth in human body. They come in cycles. And we have been studying Isis Unveiled on Sunday mornings. Speaking of avatars, this is what is said in the Isis Unveiled. Periodicity of the appearance of high beings on earth in human bodies. It says, whenever humanity is about merging into materialism and moral degeneration, a supreme spirit incarnates himself in his creatures, in his creature, selected for the purpose to restore humanity to the path of truth and virtue. And let's see what Krishna says in this regard in the fourth chapter. Even though myself unborn of changeless essence and the Lord of all existence, yet in presiding over nature which is mine, I am born but through my own Maya, the mystic power of self-ideation, the eternal thought in the eternal mind. I produce myself among creatures, O son of Bharata, whenever there is a decline of virtue and an insurrection of vice and injustice in the world. And thus, I incarnate from age to age for the preservation of the just and the destruction of the wicked and the establishment of righteousness. So, the great ones come on to the earth, mix among mankind, teach and reform. They come cyclically. And he says a very important thing here. He says, whoever, O Arjuna, knoweth my divine birth and actions to be even so, doth not, upon quitting his mortal frame, enter into another, for he entereth into me. Now, this is a very important statement. That doesn't mean when we read whole of the Bhagavata Purana and all the avatars, teachings on avatars, we will be emancipated and entered into Krishna. That's not the meaning of it. Mr. Judge explains in his notes on the Bhagavad Gita that to know all the avatars of divinity, supreme, is to have attained to highest knowledge and wisdom, which leads to emancipation. Man himself becomes divine. That is the most mysterious knowledge which Krishna spoke of in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, from which we read. And then he speaks of the exhaustless doctrine of yoga in the same 4th chapter. Where did he come? As he said, to thrust back evil and re-establish righteousness, dharma, and do away with wrong ideas, false doctrines, corruptions that had entered in the ancient traditions, and restore them to their original purity. How can it be done? It can only be done by reviving, re-promulgating the eternal wisdom religion, and that is called the exhaustless doctrine of yoga. He says, this exhaustless doctrine of yoga I formerly taught unto Vaivashvat. Vaivashvat communicated it to Manu, and Manu made it known to Ikshvaku, and being thus transmitted from one unto another, it was studied by the Rajarishis, until at length, in course of time, the mighty art was lost, O harasser of thy foes. It is even the same exhaustless, secret, eternal doctrine I have this day communicated unto thee, because thou art my devotee and my friend. Now, how do we understand this exhaustless doctrine of yoga? In the Key to Theosophy, HBB says, in answer to a question on what is theosophy, she says, we have to consider it in two aspects. Theosophia, or divine wisdom, in its highest abstract universal sense, is the abstract wisdom underlying the universe. And theosophy on earth is the same as allotted to mankind according to his capacities at any particular given cycle of his evolution. This is the exhaustless doctrine of yoga. Now, as said in the 9th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, which we read at the beginning, he speaks of how the universe evolves again and again. It comes from the unknown, evolves, and all the beings, having come out of the one life, return to it at the end of the great period of life, with all the experiences gained by them in that immense period of evolution through numberless reincarnations, individual as well as racial and national. And with this assimilated experiences, the souls which emanate from one universal soul return to it with all the experiences assimilated and become divine. So all the experiences gained by all the beings form part of the collective wisdom, upon on the basis of which the next going out, evolution of the universe takes place on a higher plane. So there is a progression. So the just like day and night, universes come into being and go out of existence, but each time they go come again into existence, it proceeds on the basis of the knowledge and wisdom gained by all the beings. So there is a continual progression. So when we regard the teaching from the cyclic evolution of the universe, then we get an idea of what the exhaustless doctrine of yoga means. Theosophy in its abstract sense, the wisdom underlying the universe, and the same thing as allotted to man according to his capacities at any given point of time. So the universe begins with divinity, with universal wisdom. And when we say knowledge and wisdom, truth, there can be no truth without knowers of it. So it is the supreme which at the beginning of evolution communicated to Vaivashvat. Who is Vaivashvat? Vivaswan is the name of the sun. What do we mean by the name of the sun? So the whole thing is, the teachings here, ancient teachings, is all in imagery, symbols. You must never take them in their dead letter sense. It is not the sun that we see. Vivaswan, as Mr. Judge points out, in that name lies a mystery. Just as a great mystery lies behind our visible sun. Behind our visible sun is a spiritual sun. And Vivaswan is one of those high beings who has progressed so far above the average humanity as to have become a solar deva, a very high solar deva. So, from Vivaswan, it was communicated to Manu. Again, who Manu is? Manu may be an individual great personage, and it has several connotations. It's difficult to go through it in a short talk like this. If we may say, roughly, the spirit of humanity. From sun is born Manu, another beautiful imagery. Swayambhava Manu contains the potentiality of all the seven great Manus to come. And it is the humanity in its total aspect, in one sense. And from Manu it passed on to Ikshvaku. Ikshvaku is again, Judge shows, he was the founder of the solar dynasty, a line of great solar devas who appeared as kings and ruled humanity in its infancy and taught them arts and sciences, imparted this divine wisdom to them. Therefore, man started his career on earth as a spiritual being, not as a savage, as science anthropologists teach. He had for his guides and instructors high exalted beings who had become perfected Jivan Muktas in prior periods of evolution. And thereafter, Rajarishis, king sages, came. In those days, in the earlier day times, the kings were great rishis. They were masters of wisdom. They ruled and guided humanity, established the civilization on a highest ideal and knowledge and wisdom. And it was studied by Raja Rishis, and at length he says it became corrupted and disappeared. It is the same doctrine that Krishna says is reviving, and this is what happens every time in the cyclic progression of mankind. The original pure teachings get corrupted, and invariably one of the great personages, high beings, descend as avatars and restore order. Now, let's consider some of the teachings of Sri Krishna. In the same chapter 4, when Sri Krishna said that he formally taught it unto Vaivashvat, Arjuna asks, "What are you saying, Krishna? I see you are born much after Vaivashvat, much after Manu and so on. But you are saying that you taught it unto Vaivashvat. How do I understand this?" Now begins the teaching, very important one. Krishna says, "Both I and thou have passed through many births, O harasser of thy foes. Mine are known unto me, but thou knowest not of thine." It is very clear. What Krishna is saying is that we are not creatures of a day. We are eternal. We are part of the supreme essence. And Arjuna has forgotten that, and Krishna remembers it. That's the only difference. So the implication of the teaching is that every one of unit of the human family is essentially divine, spiritual. The exhaustless doctrine of yoga or wisdom religion, wisdom science, pervading and underlying the universe, is in the heart of every one of us. The great initiate, the adept, is one who has realized it, and others have not yet realized it. And the mission of the great adepts is to help those who are still struggling in the bondage of conditioned existence to know this truth within themselves. Nobody can give the truth from outside. What the great teachers do is to help the individuals and nations to discover the truth in themselves. Because man himself is the embodiment, microcosm of the great macrocosm. He is a potential son of God himself. He has to become actual son of God. So his teaching begins with this, that we are not mere creatures of a day. We are not mere bodies. We are souls. We are divine egos. As the voice of the silence says, "It is a man that was, that is, for whom the hour shall never strike." But whereas the bodies, the shadows, which are born and which is, you know, our personal transitory self is called shadows, reflection of that eternal ego. And Krishna draws our attention that you are that eternal ego, a ray of the universal mind. That's what he teaches in the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. Because we forget this, we get into delusion, and our whole idea about what we are and why we are here, that knowledge being lost, we are caught up in desires and passions and bind ourselves into conditioned existence of sorrow and suffering, through wrong ideas, wrong desires, misplaced aspirations, and so on. Now, when Arjuna was grieving about, oh, all these people will die in the war, I don't want them to see dying by my hand. What does Krishna say? Look, death comes and goes only to the transitory bodies, but neither you nor I nor anyone of us is the bodies. We are eternal souls. We were never born, nor shall we ever die. Why are you worried about this? He says, thou grievest for those that may not be lamented, whilst thy sentiments are those of the expounders of the letter of the law. Those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. Once there's a report in the newspaper, I read it. His Holiness the Dalai Lama lost his elder brother. So people asked him, look, your brother passed away, you never went to see him, why? He says, what is there? You drop this body and take a part of the body. What is the soul in it? You go to sleep and wake up next day. So, he is one such wise man. Those who are wise in spiritual things grieve neither for the dead nor for the living. I myself never was not, nor thou, nor shall we, nor all the princes of this earth, nor shall we ever hereafter cease to be. What a powerful thought. If we dwell upon it and try to realize more and more, all this anxiety and fear abates. And we get that inner strength. But this wisdom is strength. It takes us to the stage of fearlessness. When we are convinced of this, what is there for us to grieve about? As a lord of this mortal frame, experience it there in infancy, youth and old age, so in future incarnation will it meet the same. One who is confirmed in this belief is not disturbed by anything that may come to pass. And then again, further on, he says, learn that he by whom all things are formed is incorruptible, and that no one is able to effect the destruction of it, which is inexhaustible, our true nature and self. These finite bodies, which envelop the souls inhabiting them, are said to belong to him, the eternal, indestructible, unprovable spirit, who is in the body. Wherefore Arjuna resolved to fight. What an inspiring words these are. Now, this body, this self, we claim it to be ours. He says these finite bodies enveloping the souls are said to belong to him, the eternal spirit. What is it that we call, as Buddha says in the Dhammapada? Your body is not yours. You yourself are not your body. You do not lay claim to your body. It is nature's. Nature claims it. Then where then your attachment to your wife, children and relatives as yours, all these things that you cling to as yours, said to belong to him? We are here to serve a high purpose of the divine eternal ego within us. This is what Krishna is teaching us. Again, why is it that we don't really understand and recognize this? It is because of we having become identified with conditions, circumstances, forms, we get into a delusion when the divine ego incarnates, takes up a body. It cannot act directly in the body. It can act only through its alter ego, its lower mind. What we call our mind is a reflection of the divine ego. It is, our true ego is so high and so pure and so divine, it cannot act directly through the body. It can act only through its temporary reflection, which is this reflection. Mind has all the potentialities of conscience, will, and power to choose, and reason, endowed with all that. And it is here to do the will of Him. Our whole purpose is to know this, conquer our desires and passions, our ignorance, and act, think and act the knowledge of the true self. And that true self, we think is not separate. The true self is eternal. If it is eternal, if it has no beginning, it has no end, then what does it imply? It implies it is universal. So our true self is universal. Our true ego is not separate from all, is part of the whole, inseparable from the whole. Whereas our lower perception, bodily perception, sense perception, or mind perception, which is involved in error because of its attachment to the lower desires, see separateness. This separateness is egotism. I and you, it's mine, separate from you. From this arises all the delusions, all the calamities, all the, what Shankara calls it as anartha, and involved in endless cycles of reincarnations. So this, we have to overcome this unwisdom and act with knowledge of the true nature of the self, to be eternal, to be universal, to be self of all, universal brotherhood. That is the essence of the teachings of Sri Krishna. When you understand this and think and act from that basis, and not think and act from ignorance, then what happens is that the binding power of our actions loses its power. Why? Because our motive for thought and action will be of universal in nature. We move away gradually from the motive of self-interest to the higher interest of fellow beings and fellow creatures. And we begin to realize in this teaching that we owe a great duty to them. We owe a great duty to the higher self. And this becomes the motive power of life and thought, which Krishna says that is the right life, that is the right knowledge, that is the right living, to act without self-interest, to act with the interest of highest good of all beings. Then the binding power of karma will not be there, and you will be released from bondage. You realize your true self. You realize your divinity and attain to immortality. And let's consider a few other teachings of Sri Krishna. In Chapter 13, a very important chapter. Again, we can dwell upon this idea, how though we are souls, yet we become deluded. Why this happens? He says this happens because the spiritual being, when it takes up form, forms which are very subtle and also gross at different levels, they are all made up of the three qualities: light, motion and inertia, sattva, rajas and tamas. And the soul becomes enmeshed in these qualities. Again, what we call matter is made up of these three qualities. We must study the philosophy of these three qualities. Very important. He says the prakriti or nature and purusha the spirit are without beginning. And know that the passions and the three qualities are sprung from nature. So nature or prakriti is said to be that which operates in producing cause and effect in actions. Individual spirit or purusha is said to be the cause of experiencing pain and pleasure. For spirit, when invested with matter or prakriti, experiences the qualities which proceed from prakriti. Its connection with these qualities is the cause of its rebirth in good and evil wounds. This is the problem. Now, the enjoyments, you know, that come from the senses and our attachment to them and desires and passions. You know, when we have desires, we naturally have aversion. So, when we actually, in the light of these teachings, analyze our sensations, our whole thought process, and analyze our attachments, aversions, in the light of these teachings of the true nature of the self, we realize, every one of us do this little experiment in truth. We are not any of these sensations, desires, passions. We are separable. We are separate. That's what the ninth chapter of Krishna says. This Supreme Spirit is separable. Separable means it appears to be involved. In reality, it is uninvolved. Those who have read the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad on the wonderful teachings about the three planes of human life, in which there is one consciousness, one ego, undergoing the experiences of the three states of waking, dream and deep sleep. One undivided consciousness experiencing these three planes. And it appears to be involved in evil in the waking state. When it goes to deep sleep state, it leaves all evil and attains to its original purity. Self is not involved. We think we are involved. True self is not involved. This is to be realized. And the eternal self, our real self, is nothing other than deity, Maheshwara, the great Lord, who is sitting in us as a spectator, the admonisher, the sustainer, the enjoyer, Paramatma, the highest soul. So is everyone. And beautifully he said in the Vishnu Purana, Ekaha samastam yadehasti kinchat. So aham, so chatvam, sa cha sarvametat. Atma surupam. After having shown this, tyaja bheda moham, give up this illusion of separateness. In the voice of the silence, it is beautifully said, teachings shown, given. Shun ignorance, shun illusion, avert thy face from world deceptions, mistrust thy senses, they are false. But within your body, shine of our sensations to which we get attached. Become detached through discrimination. Seek in the impersonal for the eternal man. You are Buddha. This is the teaching of Sri Krishna. This is the teaching of Buddha. This is the teaching of all the great teachers. This is the dharma that we have to follow. I think we'll stop here. And we are able to cover in this brief talk is a few ideas taken from Bhagavad Gita. It is so profound that even after many, 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 many lives of study, it cannot be exhausted. Mr. Judge says, it is a book studied by Mahatmas, adepts. They still study the Bhagavad Gita. And Judge said that Bhagavad Gita was his constant companion and constantly referred to it. And his whole life was guided by it. And he recommended to the students to constantly study the Bhagavad Gita. And his notes on the Bhagavad Gita is very illuminating. He brings out this quintessence of universal brotherhood and the true nature of the self. You know what usually happens in the popular discourses is Krishna is made out to be an anthropomorphic god, and the whole the spirit of the Bhagavad Gita is lost there. What Judge shows is that Krishna is supreme spirit. The etymology of Krishna itself is the sacred essence. He is present in all beings. I am the ego seated in all creatures. So, therefore, we must attain to that intuitive perception and deep conviction of the true nature of ourself, to be all, self of all, and think and act from that basis. And then our whole purpose of life will be to discharge our duty, not claim our individual rights, as beautifully put in the, conveyed in the last Sunday's talk. When we perform our duty, duty is that which is due to humanity, to our neighbors, to our family, to our enemies, to our friend and foe. Then our dues, what is due to us, we don't have to go and claim our fundamental rights and fight in the court of law. It gets automatically taken care of. We come to perceive the interdependence and interrelatedness and mutual cooperation of all beings concerned. So that's where our true duty lies. So it gives us skill in performance of action, the art, science of skill. Why skill in performance of action? When your mind, thought and motive is removed from the personality and have a higher ideal and a higher motive, and all action that come to us as duties to be performed well without self-interest, it becomes skillful. And samabuddhi, have total impartiality, whether amidst friend and foe. How beautifully Krishna says in the 6th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, 6th or 7th, I'm not able to get it. Anyway, there will be equal mindedness. Equal mindedness is called yoga. So this is what we have to practice in life. So friends, let's stop here. And we have just about 5 minutes or so. If there are any points we can take up for consideration.
Manu.
Huh.
Are they referring to single particular one manu?
No.
Or manus?
We also
hear
manus
happen.
Yeah, yeah.
Who are these manus?
Or
the single one manu?
Yeah.
Are manus?
Yeah. Now, the question that's posed is, mention was made about manu. Does manu refer to an individual? Or to a line of individuals? Right? Now it is a very abstruse teaching. If you see the Vishnu Purana, an extensive teaching given about Manu Vamshavali, a line of descent of Manus, beginning with Svayambhava Manu. Now, Manu also can be an individual personage, just like an avatar. It is, at our level, we can very roughly say, Manu represent the spirit of humanity. That's not a very accurate way of saying it. Since the difficulty of expressing the abstruse teaching, we have to resort to that kind of a loose expression, spirit of humanity. Svayambhava Manu. What does Manu mean? Manu means Manas, thinker, mind. The English word mind comes from the Sanskrit Manu. Manu means thinker, eternal thinker. We are eternal thinkers, we are Manus. Our ideation never ceases. We are manasas. This manasas, we as manasas, was born from Mahatattva. Mahatattva is universal soul, cosmic mind. We are raised with the cosmic mind. So we are eternal egos, or raised with the cosmic mind. So our humanity evolving on this earth has come from the Svayambhava Manu. The Svayambhava Manu, who is self-born, self-existing Manu, contains in himself the potentiality of the whole of the human evolution, from the beginning to the end of Mahamanmantara. And that potentiality is realized in cycles, great cycles, of 7 great cycles, 7 Manmantaras. So in any one such great cycle, some individual who has attained to that perfection may appear as Manu, as a lawgiver. It is, in other words, as the spirit of humanity evolving through this great cycles, racial and rounds and races. In each such cycle, one stage of perfection is reached, and after having reached that stage of perfection, the next stage goes on, the next manu goes on, and such cyclic progression takes place in seven great stages, beginning in each stage, beginning with one manu and ending with another manu. And the second cycle begins with another, what ends as one manu in the previous cycle becomes the seed of the next cycle, seed manu of the next cycle. And when all the seven great cyclic progression of whole humanity takes place, 14 manus, manvantaras, the whole human family is perfected, and all the experiences gained becomes so much wisdom garnered by the whole of the human family as divine egos assimilated, and which gives the basis for the next great evolutionary period. So this should give us some rough idea of what manu is. In fact,
can we
please
can we give the same ideas to who is Krishna?
Who is Krishna?
Krishna is not a human being.
Yeah.
It's a force or energy or that is descending.
Yeah.
What Manu was example.
Yeah.
It continues. Some other form, some other proof. For Krishna. Krishna was not a human being. I remember to have that in Vyasa one of the concepts we were on. He tried to in his papers submit it.
Who?
Subhara.
Ah.
So, he is associated with Vyasa. We try to present a paper, a concept of Krishna. Krishna is not a human being. The energy or the root or the source. Can we connect this Manu concept and Krishna?
Sir, you are touching up on a very, very abstruse, very highly metaphysical subject.
Here I would add.
We can do little justice to it in a short talk like this. What is the difference between manus, right, avatars, buddhas,
a creator,
bodhisattvas, is,
and even jivanmuktas.
It is too subtle and too metaphysical. I think let's leave it at this.
I wanted to open the same question.
Ultimately, we will confuse ourselves. Let's attend to simple teachings. Simple teachings which we can understand and apply. That's better. But deeper teachings, we do go. You know, in our study of Isis unveiled in the Sunday study class, we have been studying that. If I foolishly attempt to answer that question, I will confuse myself and I'll make your confusion worse confounded. So let's close here. Thank you. And next Sunday, we have a talk on the subject. Learning and wisdom at the same level. Thank you.